Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony continues its season with works by three very familiar composers, Mahler, Beethoven, and Mozart. And Saturday's evening's performance will also be led by a familiar face. While James Bagwell's current work is with the orchestra now and teaching conducting at Bard College, his ties to Tulsa go well back over 20 years. For over a decade, he was the conductor for Tulsa's Light Opera Oklahoma Summer Repertory Company. There, he led performances of Bernstein's Candide, Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, and a variety of English, American, and German operettas. Of course, he's been a regular guest with the Tulsa Symphony as well. Today, Bagwell leads Bard's choral conducting program, and he is also the associate conductor and academic director for the postgraduate The Orchestra Now, which draws musicians from conservatories around the world, prepares choruses for performances with major American and international orchestras, including the New York Philharmonic, as well as conducting operas in and around New York. For this concert, it's strictly orchestral music, though, with Mahler's Symphony No. 1, The Titan, Mozart's Little G Minor, the Symphony No. 25, and Beethoven's Leonore Overture No. 3. The concert takes place tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Details at tulsasymphony.org. James Bagwell is my guest today. James Bagwell, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Welcome back to Studio Tulsa and welcome back to Tulsa.
Thank you, Rich. It's a pleasure to be back after what seems like a very, very long time.
Well, it seems like this program was supposed to happen last season, if I remember right. And I know it must be an interesting experience to see so many musicians that you've really known over a number of years, again, when you conduct this orchestra. What's that like?
Oh, it's great. It feels like a homecoming. They sent me the list of players a few days ago, and I looked down the list, and I knew a lot of the players from back in the days when I was conducting Light Opera Oklahoma. So a lot of those same people saw me as a very young, inexperienced conductor, and now I'm working on these fantastic pieces with them, a little older and hopefully a little wiser.
That's true. I mean, this was one of your first main conducting gigs, was taking the job with Light Opera Oklahoma.
That's right. It was one of the very first things I did. I was a graduate student at Indiana University when I started doing this, and then moved to Bard College, but still continued to spend the better part of my summers in Tulsa for 10 years.
And what was that experience like? I mean, was it really a proving ground in a way?
Well, what it did was it really taught me how to conduct. You're down in a pit doing three shows in repertory. You have to move quickly through a lot of repertoire. So it really taught me how to become a conductor and what works and what doesn't work, how to be clear, how to be precise, and how to be efficient, and hopefully musical as well.
Well, this will be a vastly different experience than those performances so many years ago. And of course, you've come back many times with the symphony, oftentimes doing choral works, but this is an all orchestral program. For you, what part of this program appeals most to you?
Well, all three of these pieces are distinctive. All three are really staples in the repertoire. And often I find myself working in the peripheries of this repertoire. So it's nice to dig into something like Mahler 1. I've worked on Mahler 2, I've worked on Mahler 3, I've worked on Mahler 8, but as a choral person, as a chorus preparer. So conducting a Mahler symphony is a great experience for me.
Yeah. Well, every Mahler symphony is a journey for, I think, the listeners and also the performers as well. How do you view that journey in this particular symphony?
Well, the symphony itself is, I find it to be quite a bit more optimistic than what one normally associates with Mahler. There are movements in this piece that are borrowed from his song cycle, Songs of a Wayfarer. So the piece itself has a song quality about it. And you do sort of go through this. The piece opens, with a portrayal of spring and an awakening, and ends with this very triumphant sort of, I don't know what is being triumphed here, but there is it is a very specific kind of journey through a lot of different moods and through a lot of different musical styles, including in the third movement, even a klezmer section, which is often talked about in terms of Mahler's borrowings from different styles.
Yeah, that third movement is very unusual because it uses, depending on whether you're German or French, for Jacques or Bruder Martin, very, very famous nursery song at the beginning. But in that trio section, yes, it is like you've stumbled into a Jewish country festival, if you will.
Right. And there's also a quote from the Songs of a Wayfarer in that middle of the piece as well. So there's a lot of different kinds of styles. And one thinks that Mahler is commenting on symphonic structure as much as he is participating in symphonic structure as a composer.
It's hard to realize what a revolutionary piece the Symphony No. 1 was because of what Mahler would write in the next 7 or 8 symphonies to come. But it really was. I mean, we have to realize that the symphony genre was still very much influenced by Beethoven. Brahms took it another major step, but it was still very much a Beethoven construct, really. And then Mahler comes in.
That's right.
And it's completely different.
Well, you know, and Mahler is doing something that a lot of composers during that time, that we're talking about the very end of the 19th century, lots of composers like Richard Strauss, for example, were writing tone poems, which followed sort of a symphonic structure, but often took the name of whatever it was they were writing about, like Also Sprach Zarathustra or Don Quixote. But Mahler, I think it's audacious that he just says, no, this is a symphony, just like Brahms wrote, just like Beethoven wrote, just like Schumann, just like Mendelssohn. So to call itself a symphony, I think is pretty bold, especially with the incredible influence and I think nervous making it made to write symphonies after Brahms, after Beethoven, and so forth. There's a lot of legacy and a lot of anxiety of influence here.
One of the things about the Mahler symphonies and each movement of them is they can be very episodic. And obviously the challenge for a conductor is to indulge those episodes, but you have to build that into the whole movement. And you know, I think it's almost impossible to think of it as a whole symphony, but at least a whole movement. How do you do that as far as, you know, bringing out the episodic nature of it, but connecting it into sort of a satisfying whole? Because even in the course of a movement, you know, you cover a lot of ground.
Well, at the risk of sounding simple, it's a little bit like a very long road trip, which I did quite a bit during the pandemic to visit my parents, driving from New York to Alabama. The goal was always to get to Alabama, but you have to take exits to get something to eat or take an exit to go to a motel to spend the night. And in many ways, these episodes are sort of diversions, temporary diversions, which adds to the richness of the trip itself. The first movement is really kind of an old-fashioned sonata form that Beethoven used, that Mendelssohn used. And the second movement is a dance, which would have been typical in a symphony, except sometimes in the third movement. It's that third movement, though, that I find the most interesting episodic moment, because it bookends with the Frère Jacques. But in the middle of it, it does take these little windy side roads away from that. So I think there is this journey, and how do you pace the piece in a way that you're telling the story, but not getting too sidetracked by the episodes themselves? That's kind of the fun and the challenge of this work, telling a story with all the richness of detail, but without losing the point of that story.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the biggest contrasts, well, I guess perhaps between the first and second movement is another one like that, because the Lendler comes in full tilt and it has that three feel, and it does have the feeling of dance. But the biggest, I think, change is between the end of the third movement, you've had this Frère Jacques theme that is repeated and repeated, and it slowly fades away. And then at the beginning of the fourth, as you said, it ends up a statement of triumph. But at the beginning of the movement, it is some of the greatest storm and drang. You know, if we can move that forward 150 years, you're into the Tempest from the very opening bar.
That's right. That's right. And there's a lot of borrowing in that last movement as well from both Liszt and Wagner. Parsifal, there's a little moment of Parsifal in there. And there's some borrowing from the Liszt Dante Symphony as well. So you do, right? You go, that's really the stormiest part of the piece is the last movement. But then he drifts into these absolutely heavenly melodic lines and the strings, particularly the thing slows down and you're introduced to some themes that are totally original and provide a real interesting emotional contrast between that very fiery beginning and that triumphant ending.
Yeah. And of course, at the very beginning, within the first minute or so, you hear this theme that will come back at the end in a major version that sort of gives you that sense of triumph. But why don't we hear a little bit of the opening of that finale? Here's the music of Mahler, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony with my guest today, James Bagwell, a longtime guest of Tulsa music scene. He is currently the academic director and associate conductor of the orchestra now. He'll be guest conducting the Tulsa Symphony in the music of Mahler's for Symphony No. 1, along with Mozart and Beethoven this Saturday night. Here is the opening of the final movement of Mahler's Symphony No. 1. That's music by Mahler, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra with my guest today, James Bagwell, longtime friend and acquaintance and wonderful musical colleague for our city. He is the academic director and associate conductor of the orchestra now and teaches conducting, choral conducting, especially at Bard College. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, of course, that Mahler symphony is, that takes a lot of rehearsal time in and of itself. But you also have two other important works by Mozart and Beethoven. And when I think of the Mozart Symphony No. 25, I think of the opening of that symphony. You know, everybody talks about the last three symphonies of Mozart and maybe the last four or five, really, or six, as being really the mature Mozart. But I think that first movement of the Symphony No. 25 compares favorably with any symphonic movement Mozart ever wrote.
I agree. And you know, he was only 17 years old when he wrote it.
I know.
Which is just astonishing. But that, you know, the opening is so full of fire. And you had mentioned Sturm und Drang, Storm and Stress earlier. This is a real, I think, direct callback to the music of Franz Joseph Haydn, as a matter of fact. But you have this very piercing quality in the opening of that symphony, which is just fantastic.
Tell me about your approach to this piece. It is called the Little G Minor to separate it from the Symphony No. 40, which is the Great G Minor. And really, those are the only reasons for the title, because he wrote two really wonderful symphonies in G Minor. What is your approach to this work?
My approach is, how do you make a piece sound like chamber music in a hall that's very large? And we did that in part by using all the strings that we have that we're using for the Mahler, we're using in the Mozart. And without getting too technical, really it sort of boils down to your articulation and the way that you shape this. So it sounds like Mozart, but it also works in a fairly large hall. So that's the big challenge, I think, in doing it and really articulating things in a way that will ring in that hall.
Interesting. I never thought of the hall as sort of a factor, but I can understand why it would be when you have the big forces of Mahler. You have all this sound that's filling it up. And of course, when you're playing the Mozart, it has to have some sense of delicacy. And the
that's
size
right.
of the hall probably does affect how the musicians play that.
It's true. And in fact, we discussed about maybe reducing the string size for the Mozart, but then I just decided that it just wouldn't make sense given the size of the stage and the size of the area where the audience will sit. So my responsibility is to make that large string section sound like a smaller, almost Baroque orchestra. So that's one of the challenges of doing a piece like that in a big space.
Hmm. Are you of the feeling that you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing things like a Mozart 25 or some of the middle symphonies of Haydn or, you know, the ones that would have been written at Esterhazy in a big concert hall like that. It's not the proper space.
Well, you know, we're also in a hall that has electricity, which would have not been true at Esterhazy or in Vienna.
Right.
So I think we make accommodations. Music is a living document, and we want to bring it to life in whatever setting we're given. And so there are some people out there, there are some purists, and that's fine. And I understand their point of view, but how exciting it is to hear a work like the 25th Symphony of Mozart played by a big string section. It's really thrilling. It's a really thrilling sound.
And of course, the larger the string section, the more precise every player has to be, I would think.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's correct.
You know, the first movement of the Mozart Symphony number 25 is kind of become famous because if you know the film Amadeus, it was used prominently in that film. What else do we need to know about this symphony as far as the other three movements?
I don't know if there's really anything in particular that you need to be prepared for other than just sort of reveling in the fact that this is a 17-year-old genius exploring what it means to write a symphony. The fact that it's his 25th symphony and he's 17 years old gives you a fairly clear indication of what we're talking about here in terms of the proclivity of Mozart as a composer. But he's also working out how to write a symphony. And that is very interesting. My favorite movement, I love the first movement. My favorite movement might be the last movement, which is just a very sort of straightforward, simple theme that he works through a variety of articulations, a variety of dynamics, key shifts, and so forth. So there's a lot of diversity in that last movement. I don't think people know the last movement. They mostly know the first movement, as you said, because of the movie. But, you know, that symphony was not even played in the United States until the very, very end of the 19th century. So it wasn't even really a well-known symphony with the audiences until Amadeus.
It's interesting. When you hear the opening of that final movement, you actually can sort of look at it at the very beginning and say, oh, yeah, this is the 17-year-old, because that theme is so simple. And yet he still weaves an inventive set of extrapolations on that very simple theme.
You can think of it in relationship to the third movement, going back to Mahler, you know, the taking a children's song, setting it in a minor key rather than the major key, and then treating it like a round with all this very inventive counterpoint going through all the instruments of the orchestra. I mean, Mozart's orchestra is obviously quite a bit smaller, but he's doing a similar kind of thing where you take what is a might feel like not a very compelling theme, but then he puts it through its paces and you realize, wait, no one except Mozart could have written a theme like that. It's almost written to be developed.
Yeah. Well, why don't we hear a portion of that finale from the Mozart Symphony number 25, one of three works, which will be conducted by my guest today, this Saturday, James Bagwell, who will lead the symphony, Tulsa Symphony and the Mahler Symphony number 1, the Mozart Symphony number 25, and Beethoven's Leonore Overture number 3. Here's the opening of the final movement of the Symphony number 25. That's music by Mozart from his Symphony number 25, one of three works to be performed by my guest today. These are all sort of Viennese works in a large sense. Yeah, Mozart Symphony number 25, the Beethoven Leonore Overture, and Mahler Symphony number 1. That takes place at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center this Saturday evening at 7:30, and James Backwell is my guest today. Well, Beethoven's Leonore Overture No. 3 opens the evening. This is a really amazing overture. I know it's probably for your conducting students. It's something everybody tackles at one point or another. Out of all the overtures that Beethoven wrote surrounding Fidelio, this is really the one that stands out, I think.
It's a really compelling. It's like a little miniature opera in 14 minutes. And flute players use the fast section often as an orchestral audition excerpt. It's just really a fresh sounding overture. And I think Beethoven thought it was probably too good for an opera, you know? And he probably spent more time writing this overture than Rossini spent writing an entire opera. A lot of care went into this particular overture.
Well, you know, it's interesting. He wrote so many overtures for the start of Fidelio. And actually, I think Leonore was actually supposed to be a different operatic or vocal piece. And then he would put them on Fidelio. What do you think he was looking for?
I don't know. I think the whole Fidelio is an interesting work. I've worked on it in the past. I'm not sure that opera was where Beethoven lived, but he wanted to live there really badly. So you can feel, I mean, the whole opera itself is about struggle and freedom. And I think that was part of Beethoven's mindset in writing this opera, Fidelio, and in particular this overture. There is this opening where it does feel like a struggle. And I think it's designed to give us a sense of Floristan being in this dungeon. And then you have this trumpet call sort of right in the middle of the overture, which is his release from prison by Leonora. So, but it is a work of struggle and victory, you know, in the same way that maybe Mahler one is as well.
Yeah, well, there was always a struggle in every Beethoven work. You mentioned, you said, you know, he really wanted to be an opera composer, but he wasn't all that successful during his time. And I'm wondering, do you think it was financial? Because, you know, the operatic stage was a great, if you had a successful opera, you made a lot more money as a composer. Was it that aspect that perhaps appealed to him? Because we think of him as such a symphonist and chamber music composer.
I think everybody wanted to write their magic flute. the subject matter of Fidelio has nothing to do with magic flute, but in fact, musically, they're very similar. So I think that was also part, as to go back to your question, I think that, you know, that's just what composers were expected to do. And yes, there is a financial component to that, making a living as a composer, and also the fame with which operatic composition would bring a composer, like it did for Mozart. You know, people know the Mozart symphonies, but in my opinion, and it is really my opinion only, that I think Mozart is at his heart an opera composer, and Beethoven at his heart may be a string quartet composer. Mm. That's where Beethoven worked out some of his most incredible and really sort of delicious musical experimentation. You know, you work outside of a genre, but you ultimately bring to the genre that you're working in, whether it be a symphony, a piano sonata, or so forth, it eventually sort of winds its way back into what you are initially at your heart as a composer, whether that be an opera composer, a symphonist, or so forth.
My guest today is James Bagwell, the academic director and associate conductor of the Orchestra Now, a young orchestra featuring some of the finest graduates from conservatories around the world that participate in a series in New York and at Bard College. He also teaches conducting and choral conducting at Bard College. He also prepares choruses for the New York Philharmonic performances and other major orchestras. He'll be leading the Tulsa Symphony and Gustav Mahler Symphony No. 1, along with the Mozart Symphony No. 25 and Beethoven's Leonore Overture No. 3, Saturday evening at 7:30. Well, at the beginning of March, you had a performance with the Orchestra Now and the vocal program at Bard for Janacek's Cunning Little Vixen. Obviously, this is one of those wonderful pieces that you don't hear enough on the opera stage.
This piece is magical. I've worked on a lot of opera scores over the years, but never one with such detail to orchestral writing, with maybe the exception of Puccini. And I'm sure people would argue with me about that. But the detail in this orchestral writing reveals so much about the characters, And it, I think it's some of Janáček's best orchestral writing. We did it in English. It was originally supposed to be sung in Czech, which is a difficult language in which to sing. So I found myself completely fascinated by how this translation worked and also how the melodic style worked in English. It's challenging. I'll tell you, it's really challenging. It's as challenging as doing it in English as it is in Czech in many respects.
Is it because of the way the vowels and consonants work between the two languages as far as
yeah,
what you land
that's,
on?
That's it. And Czech has consonants that don't exist in any other language. There's one, an R with a ha check over it, which is this sort of odd sound, which actually you can vocalize on that sound. So it's hard to try to recreate that in an English translation.
Well, I know Bard College has an active music schedule, and I know one of the big highlights every summer is Summerfest. Will you be involved with the Summerfest this summer?
Yeah, it's a big summer. Where the Bard Music Festival is Rachmaninoff and his world. So we'll be doing Rachmaninoff. We'll be doing I'll conduct the Vespers, which is really one of the great choral works of the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. So it's going to be I think, and Rachmaninoff is such a fabulous composer. And so this will be fun for all of us.
Was there a festival last summer, or was it truncated because of COVID?
We did Nadja Boulanger and her world. We did a full-blown festival, Rich. We did not compromise at all. We were in a very good place. Everybody was getting tested 3 to 4 times a week. So we had a really fantastic summer, and it was great to work on works by Boulanger, who was really one of the great pedagogues of music. And it's rare that a music festival is dedicated to a teacher in the way that we did for Nadja Boulanger, and her sister Lily was featured prominently on this festival as well. And what a great composer she was.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing the Mahler Symphony No. 1, as well as works by Mozart and Beethoven, Saturday evening at 7:30 at the PAC. James, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Rich, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you, and Tulsa is extremely lucky to have you.
Oh,
just,
you're so kind.
Just so, so lucky to have you.
Well, we're lucky to have you here in town this week. Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
James Bagwell will lead the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center in music by Gustav Mahler, the Symphony No. 1, along with works by Mozart and Beethoven. For information on the program, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, we're going to leave you with a little more music from Mahler Symphony No. 1. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.